Of course, they were old enough. Dede was 18, Elsa almost 15. They were in good schools. They both had good teachers. But was it enough? They had never become assimilated. Neither of them had close schoolmates or friends. They seemed comfortable only with Reno. And what did they really have in common with that large boy who was much older and yet more childish than they? No, I had to leave Naples. I could try to live in Rome, for example, and for Ima's sake resume relations with Nino, only on the level of friendship, of course. Or return to Florence so that Pietro could be closer to his daughters and thus would not move across the ocean. The decision seemed particularly urgent when one night Lila came upstairs with a quarrelsome look, evidently in a bad mood, and asked me, "Is it true that you told Dede to stop seeing Gennaro?" I was embarrassed. I had only explained to my daughter that she shouldn't be stuck to him all the time. "See him? She can see him when she wants. I'm only afraid that Gennaro might be annoyed. He's grown up. She's a girl."
"Lenu, be clear. You think my son isn't good for your daughter?"
I stared at her in bewilderment.
"Good how? You know perfectly well she's in love."
I burst out laughing. "Dede? Reno?
Why? Don't you think it's possible that your child has lost her head over mine?"
20. Until that moment, I had paid little attention to the fact that Dede, unlike her sister, who happily changed suitors every month, had never had a declared and ostentatious passion. I had attributed that withdrawn attitude partly to the fact that she didn't feel pretty, partly to her rigor, and from time to time I had teased her. "Are all the boys in your school unappealing?" She was a girl who didn't forgive frivolity in anyone, above all in herself, but especially in me. The times she had seen me, I wouldn't say flirt, but even just laugh with a man, or, I don't know, give a warm welcome to some boy who had brought her home, she made her disapproval clear, and on one unpleasant occasion some months earlier, had even gone so far as to use a vulgarity in dialect to me, which had made me furious. But maybe it wasn't a question of a war on frivolity. After Lila's words, I began to observe Dede, and I realized that her protective attitude toward Lila's son could not be reduced, as I had thought until then, to a long childhood affection or a heated adolescent defense of the humiliated and offended. I realized, rather, that her asceticism was the effect of an intense and exclusive bond with Reno that had endured since early childhood. That frightened me. I thought of the long duration of my love for Nino, and I said to myself in alarm, "Dede is setting off on the same path," but with the aggravating factor that if Nino was an extraordinary boy and had become a handsome, intelligent, successful man, Reno is an insecure, uneducated youth without attractions, without any future. And, if I thought about it, more than Stefano, he physically recalled his grandfather, Don Achille. I decided to speak to her. It was a few months until her final exams. She was very busy. It would be easy for her to say to me, "I've got a lot to do. Let's put it off." But Dede wasn't Elsa, who was able to reject me, who could pretend. With my oldest daughter, it was enough to ask, and I was sure that she, at any moment, whatever she was doing, would answer with the greatest frankness. I asked, "Are you in love with Reno?"
"Yes."
"And he?"
"I don't know."
"Since when have you had that feeling?"
"Forever."
"But if he doesn't reciprocate?"
"My life would no longer have meaning."
"What are you thinking of doing?" I'll tell you after the exams.
Tell me now.
If he wants me, we'll go away.
Where?
I don't know, but certainly away from here.
He also hates Naples?
Yes. He wants to go to Bologna.
Why?
It's a place where there's freedom.
I looked at her with affection. Dede, you know that neither your father nor I will let you go.
There's no need for you to let me go. I'm going, and that's it.
What about money?
I'll work.
And your sisters? And me?
Some day or other, Mama, we'll have to separate anyway.
I emerged from that conversation drained of strength. Although she had presented unreasonable things in an orderly fashion, I tried to behave as if she were saying very reasonable things. Later, anxiously, I tried to think what to do. Dede was only an adolescent in love. One way or another, I would make her obey. The problem was Leela. I was afraid of her. I knew immediately that the fight with her would be bitter. She had lost Tina. Rina was her only child. She and Enzo had gotten him away from drugs in time, using very harsh methods. She wouldn't accept that I, too, would cause him suffering. All the more since the company of my two daughters was doing him good. He was even working a little with Enzo, and it was possible that separating him from them would send him off the rails again. Besides, any possible regression of Reno worried me, too. I was fond of him. He had been an unhappy child and was an unhappy youth. Certainly, he had always loved Dede. Certainly, giving her up would be unbearable for him. But what to do? I became more affectionate. I didn't want any misunderstandings. I valued him. I would always try to help him in everything. He had only to ask. But anyone could see that he and Dede were very different, and that any solution they came up with would, in a short time, be disastrous. Thus, I proceeded, and Reno became in turn kinder. He fixed broken blinds, dripping faucets, with the three sisters acting as helpers. But Leela didn't appreciate her son's availability. If he spent too much time at our house, she summoned him with an imperious cry. 21. I didn't confine myself to that strategy. I telephoned Pietro. He was about to move to Boston. Now he seemed determined. He was mad at Doriana, who, he said with disgust, had turned out to be an untrustworthy person. Completely without ethics. Then he listened to me attentively. He knew Reno. He remembered him as a child and knew what he had become as an adult. He asked a couple of times to be sure of not making a mistake. He has no drug problems? And once only, does he work? Finally, he said, it's preposterous. We agreed that between the two of them, taking account of our daughter's sensitivity, even a flirtation had to be ruled out. I was glad that we saw things the same way. I asked him to come to Naples and talk to Dede. He promised he would, but he had endless commitments and appeared only near Dede's exams, in essence, to say goodbye to his daughters before leaving for America. We hadn't seen each other for a long time. He had his usual distracted expression. His hair was by now grizzled. His body had become heavier. He hadn't seen Leela and Enzo since Tina's disappearance. When he came to see the girls, he would stay only a few hours or take them off on a trip. And he devoted himself to them. Pietro was a kind man, careful not to cause embarrassment with his role as a prestigious professor. He talked to them at length, assuming that serious and sympathetic expression that I knew well, and that in the past had irritated me, but that today I appreciated because it wasn't feigned and was natural also to Dede.
I don't know what he said about Tina, but while Enzo remained impassive, Leela cheered up. She thanked him for his wonderful letter of years earlier, said it had helped her a lot. Only then did I learn that Pietro had written to her about the loss of her daughter, and Leela's genuine gratitude surprised me. He was modest. She excluded Enzo from the conversation completely and began to speak to my ex-husband about Neapolitan things. She dwelt at length on the Palazzo Cellamare, about which I knew nothing except that it was above Chiaia. While she, I discovered then, knew in minute detail the structure, the history, the treasures. Pietro listened with interest. I fumed. I wanted him to stay with his daughters, and especially deal with Dede. When Leela finally left him free, and Pietro, after spending some time with Elsa and Ima, found a way of going off with Dede, father and daughter talked a lot, peacefully. I observed them from the window as they walked back and forth along the Stradone. It struck me, I think for the first time, how similar they were physically. Dede didn't have her father's bushy hair, but she had his large frame, and also something of his clumsy walk. She was a girl of 18. She had a feminine softness, but at every gesture, every step, she seemed to enter and exit Pietro's body as if it were her ideal dwelling. I stayed at the window, hypnotized by the sight. The time extended. They talked so long that Elsa and Ima began to get restless. "I also have things to tell Papa," said Elsa. "And if he leaves, when will I tell him?" Ima murmured. "He said he talked to me, too." Finally, Pietro and Dede returned. They seemed in a good mood. In the evening, all three girls gathered around to listen to him. He said he was going to work in a very big, very beautiful red brick building that had a statue at the entrance. The statue represented a man whose face and clothes were dark, except for one shoe, which the students touched every day for good luck, and so it had become highly polished and sparkled in the sun like gold. They had a good time together, leaving me out. I thought, as always on those occasions, now that he doesn't have to be a father every day, he's a very good father. Even Ima adores him. Maybe with men, things can't go otherwise. Live with them for a while, have children, and then they're gone. The superficial ones, like Nino, would go without feeling any type of obligation. The serious ones, like Pietro, wouldn't fail in any of their duties, and would, if necessary, give the best of themselves. Anyway, the time of faithfulness and permanent relationships was over for men and for women. But then, why did we look at poor Gennaro, called Reno, as a threat? Dede would live her passion, would use it up, would go on her way. Every so often she would see him again. They would exchange some affectionate words. The process was that. Why did I want something different for my daughter? The question embarrassed me. I announced in my best authoritarian tone that it was time to go to bed. Elsa had just finished vowing that in a few years, once she got her high school diploma, she would go and live in the United States with her father. And Ima was tugging on Pietro's arm. She wanted attention. She was no doubt about to ask if she could join him, too. Dede sat in uncertain silence. Maybe, I thought, things are already resolved. Reno has been put aside. Now she'll say to Elsa, "You have to wait 4 years. I'm finishing high school now, and in a month, at most, I'm going to Papa's." 22. But as soon as Pietro and I were alone, I had only to look at his face to understand that he was very worried. He said, there's nothing to do. What do you mean? Dede functions by theorems.
What did she tell you?
It's not important what she said, but what she will certainly do.
She'll go to bed with him?
Yes. She has a very firm plan, with the stages precisely marked out. Right after her exams, she'll make a declaration to Reno, lose her virginity. They'll leave together and live by begging, putting the work ethic in crisis.
Don't joke.
I'm not joking. I'm reporting her plan to you word for word.
Easy for you to be sarcastic, since you can avoid it, leaving the role of the bad mother to me.
She's counting on me. She said that as soon as that boy wants, she'll come to Boston with him.
I'll break her legs.
Or maybe he and she will break yours.
We talked into the night, at first about Dede, then also about Elsa and Ima. Finally, everything. Politics, literature, the books I was writing, the newspaper articles, a new essay he was working on. We hadn't talked so much for a long time. He teased me good-humoredly for always taking, in his view, a middle position. He made fun of my halfway feminism, my halfway Marxism, my halfway Freudianism, my halfway Foucaultism, my halfway subversiveness. Only with me, he said in a slightly harsher tone, you never used half measures. He sighed. Nothing was right for you. I was inadequate in everything. That other man was perfect. But now, he acted like the rigorous person, and he ended up in the socialist gang. Elena, Elena, how you have tormented me. You were angry with me even when those kids pointed a gun at me. And you brought to our house your childhood friends who were murderers. You remember? But so what? You're Elena. I loved you so much. We have two children. And of course, I still love you. I let him talk. Then I admitted that I had often held senseless positions. I even admitted that he was right about Nino. He had been a great disappointment. And I tried to return to Dede and Reno. I was worried. I didn't know how to manage the issue. I said that to keep the boy away from our daughter would cause, among other things, trouble with Leela, and that I felt guilty. I knew she would consider it an insult. He nodded.
You have to help her.
I don't know how to.
She's trying everything possible to engage her mind and emerge from her grief, but she's unable to.
It's not true. She did before. Now she's not even working. She's not doing anything.
You're wrong.
Leela had told him that she spent entire days in the Biblioteca Nazionale. She wanted to learn all she could about Naples. I looked at him dubiously. Leela again in a library? Not the neighborhood library of the 50s, but the prestigious, inefficient Biblioteca Nazionale? That's what she was doing when she disappeared from the neighborhood? That was her new mania? And why had she not told me about it? Or had she told Pietro just so that he would tell me?
She hid it from you?
She'll talk to me about it when she needs to.
Urge her to continue. It's unacceptable that a person so gifted stops school in fifth grade.
Leela does only what she feels like.
That's how you want to see her.
I've known her since she was six.
Maybe she hates you for that.
She doesn't hate me.
It's hard to observe every day that you are free, and she has remained a prisoner. If there's an inferno, it's inside her unsatisfied mind. I wouldn't want to enter it even for a few seconds.
Pietro used precisely that phrase, enter it, and his tone was of horror, of fascination, of pity. I repeated, Leela doesn't hate me at all. He laughed.
All right, as you like.
Let's go to bed. He looked at me uncertainly. I hadn't made up the cot as I usually did.
Together. It was a dozen years since we had even touched each other. All night, I was afraid that the girls would wake up and find us in the same bed. I lay looking in the shadowy light at that large, disheveled man, snoring faintly. Rarely, when we were married, had he slept with me for long. Usually he tormented me for a long time with his sex and his arduous orgasm. He fell asleep, then he got up and went to study. This time lovemaking was pleasant, a farewell embrace. We both knew it wouldn't happen again, and so we felt good. From Doriana, Pietro had learned what I had been unable or unwilling to teach him, and he did all he could so that I would notice. Around 6, I woke him. I said, "It's time for you to go." I went out to the car with him. He urged me yet again to look after the girls, especially Dede. We shook hands. We kissed each other on the cheeks. He left. I walked idly to the newsstand. The news dealer was unpacking the papers. I went home with, as usual, 3 dailies, whose headlines I would look at, but no more. I was making breakfast. I was thinking about Pietro and our conversation. I could have lingered on any subject, his bland resentment, Dede, his somewhat facile psychologizing about Leela. And yet sometimes a mysterious connection is established between our mental circuits and the events whose echo is about to reach us. His description of Pasquale and Nadia, the childhood friends he had polemically alluded to, as murderers, had stayed with me. To Nadia, I realized, I by now applied the word murderer, naturally. To Pasquale, no, I continued to reject it. Yet again, I was asking myself why, when the telephone rang. It was Leela calling from downstairs. She had heard me when I went out with Pietro, and when I returned, she wanted to know if I had bought the papers. She had just heard on the radio that Pasquale had been arrested. 23. That news absorbed us entirely for weeks, and I was more involved, I admit, in the story of our friend than in Dede's exams. Leela and I hurried to Carmen's house, but she already knew everything, or at least the essentials, and she appeared serene. Pasquale had been arrested in the mountains of Cerino, in the Avellinese. The carabinieri had surrounded the farmhouse where he was hiding, and he had behaved in a reasonable way. He hadn't reacted violently. He hadn't tried to escape. "Now," Carmen said, "I only have to hope that they don't let him die in prison the way Papa did." She continued to consider her brother a good person. In fact, on the wave of her emotion, she went so far as to say that the three of us, she, Leela, and I, carried within us a quantity of wickedness much greater than his. "We have been capable of attending only to our own affairs," she murmured, bursting into tears. "Not Pasquale. Pasquale grew up as our father taught him." Owing to the genuine suffering in those words, Carmen managed, perhaps for the first time since we had known one another, to have the better of Leela and me. For example, Leela didn't make objections, and, as for me, I felt uneasy at her speech. The Peluso siblings, by their mere existence in the background of my life, confused me. I absolutely ruled out that their father, the carpenter, had taught them, as Franco had done with Dede, to challenge the silly moral fable of Menenius Agrippa. But both, Carmen less, Pasquale more, had always known instinctively that the limbs of a man are not nourished when he fills the belly of another, and that those who would make you believe it should sooner or later get what they deserve. Although they were different in every way, with their history they formed a block that I couldn't relate to me or to Leela, but that I couldn't distance us from either. So maybe one day I said to Carmen, "You should be happy, now that Pasquale is in the hands of the law, we can understand better how to help him. And the next day, I said to Leela, in complete agreement with her, laws and guarantees count for nothing, whereas they should protect those who have no power. In prison, they'll kill him. At times, I even admitted, with the two of them, that although the violence we had experienced from birth now disgusted me, a modest amount was needed to confront the fierce world we lived in. Along those confusing lines, I undertook to do everything possible for Pasquale. I didn't want him to feel, unlike his companion Nadia, who was treated with great consideration, like a nobody whom nobody cared about. 24. I looked for reliable lawyers. I even decided through telephone calls to track down Nino, the only member of parliament I knew personally. I never managed to speak to him, but a secretary, after lengthy negotiations, made an appointment for me. "Tell him," I said coldly, "that I'll bring our daughter." At the other end of the line, there was a long moment of hesitation. "I'll let him know," the woman said finally. A few minutes later, the telephone rang. It was the secretary again. "The Honorable Salvatore would be very happy to meet us in his office in Piazza Risorgimento." But in the following days, the place and hour of the appointment changed continuously. The Honorable had left. The Honorable had returned but was busy. The Honorable had an interminable sitting in Parliament. I marveled at how difficult it was to have direct contact, in spite of my modest fame, in spite of my journalist credentials, in spite of the fact that I was the mother of his child, with a representative of the people. When everything was finally set, the location was nothing less than Montecitorio, the Parliament itself. Ima and I got dressed up and left for Rome. She asked if she could take her precious electoral flyer. I said yes. In the train, she kept looking at it, as if to prepare for a comparison between the photograph and the reality. In the capital, we took a taxi. We presented ourselves at Montecitorio. At every obstacle, I showed our papers and said, mainly so that Ima could hear, "We're expected by the Honorable Salvatore. This is his daughter, Ima. Ima Salvatore." We waited a long time. The child at one point said, in the grip of anxiety, "What if the people hold him up?" I reassured her, "They won't hold him up." Nino finally arrived, preceded by the secretary, a very attractive young woman. Well-dressed, radiant, he hugged and kissed his daughter rapturously, picked her up and held her the whole time, as if she were still little. But what surprised me was the immediate assurance with which Ima clung to his neck and said to him happily, unfolding the leaflet, "You're handsomer than in this photo. You know my teacher voted for you?" Nino was very attentive to her. He had her tell him about school, about her friends, about the subjects she liked best. He paid only the slightest attention to me. By now I belonged to another life, an inferior life, and it seemed pointless to waste his energies. I talked about Pasquale. He listened, but without neglecting his daughter, and nodded at the secretary to take notes. At the end of my account, he asked seriously, "What do you expect from me?" To find out if he's in good health and is getting the full protection of the law.
"Is he cooperating with the law?"
"No, and I doubt that he ever will."
"He'd be better off."
"Like Nadia?" He gave a small, embarrassed laugh. "Nadia is behaving in the only way possible, if she doesn't intend to spend the rest of her life in jail." "Nadia is a spoiled girl. Pasquale isn't." He didn't answer right away. He pressed Ima's nose as if it were a button and imitated the sound of a bell. They laughed together, and then he said, "I'll see what your friend's situation is. I'm here to be sure that the rights of everyone are protected. but I'll tell him that the relatives of the people he killed also have rights. You don't play at being a rebel, shed real blood, and then cry, "We have rights." Do you understand, Ima?
Yes.
Yes, Papa.
Yes, Papa.
And if the teacher mistreats you, call me. I said, if the teacher mistreats her, she'll manage by herself.
The way Pasquale Peluso managed?
Pasquale never asked anyone to protect him.
And that vindicates him?
No. But it's significant that if Ima has to assert her right, you tell her, call me.
For your friend Pasquale, aren't you calling me?
I left very nervous and unhappy. But for Ima, it was the most important day of her first 7 years of life. The days passed. I thought it had been a waste of time. But in fact, Nino kept his word. He looked into Pasquale's situation. It was from him I learned, later, things that the lawyers either didn't know or didn't tell us about. The involvement of our friend in some notorious political crimes that had afflicted Campania was at the center of Nadia's detailed confession. But this had also been common knowledge for some time. The new information, instead, was that she now tended to ascribe everything to him, even acts of minor interest. Thus, the long list of Pasquale's crimes included mentions of the murder of Gino, of Bruno Saccavo, the death of Manuela Salata, and finally, that of her sons, Marcello and Michele. What agreement did your old girlfriend make with the Carabinieri? I asked Nino the last time I saw him.
I don't know.
Nadia is telling a pile of lies.
I don't rule it out. But one thing I know for sure, she is ruining a lot of people who thought they were safe. So tell Lena to be careful. Nadia has always hated her.
25. So many years had passed, and yet Nino didn't miss a chance to mention Lila, to show that he was solicitous of her, even at a distance. I was there with him. I had loved him. I had beside me his daughter, who was licking a chocolate ice cream cone. But he considered me only a friend of his youth, to whom he could show off the extraordinary path he had traveled, from his high school desk to a seat in Parliament. In that last encounter of ours, his greatest compliment was to put me on the same rung of the ladder. I don't remember in relation to what subject, he said. The two of us climbed very high. But even as he uttered that sentence, I read in his gaze that the Declaration of Equality was a sham. He considered himself much better than me, and the proof was that, in spite of my successful books, I stood before him as a petitioner. His eyes smiled at me cordially, suggesting, "Look what you lost by losing me." I left in a hurry with the child. I was sure that he would have had quite a different attitude if Lila had been present. He would have mumbled. He would have felt mysteriously crushed, maybe even a little ridiculous with that preening. When we reached the garage where I had left the car, that time I had come to Rome by car, something occurred to me for the first time. Only with Lila had Nino put at risk his own ambitions. On Ischia, and for the following year, he had given in to a romance that could have caused him nothing but trouble, an anomaly in the journey of his life. At the time, he was already a well-known and very promising university student. He had taken up with Nadia, that was clear to me now, because she was the daughter of Professor Galliani. Because he had considered her the key to gaining access to what then appeared to us a superior class. His choices had always been consistent with his ambitions. Hadn't he married Eleonora out of self-interest? And I, myself, when I had left Pietro for him, wasn't I in fact a well-connected woman, a writer of some success, with ties to an important publishing house?
useful, in short, to his career? And all the other women who had helped him, didn't they come under the same logic? Nino loved women, certainly, but he was, above all, a cultivator of useful relations. What his intelligence produced would never, alone, have had sufficient energy to assert itself without the web of power that he had been weaving since he was a boy. What about Leela? She had gone to school up to fifth grade. She was the very young wife of a shopkeeper. If Stefano had known of their relationship, he could have killed them both. Why had Nino, in that case, gambled his entire future? I put Ima in the car. I scolded her for letting the ice cream drip on the dress bought for the occasion. I started the car. I left Rome. Maybe what had attracted Nino was the impression of having found in Leela what he, too, presumed he had, and that now, just by comparison, he discovered that he didn't have. She possessed intelligence and didn't put it to use, but rather wasted it, like a great lady for whom all the riches of the world are merely a sign of vulgarity. That was the fact that must have beguiled Nino, the gratuitousness of Leela's intelligence. She stood out among so many because she, naturally, did not submit to any training, to any use, or to any purpose. All of us had submitted, and that submission had, through trials, failures, successes, reduced us. Only Leela, nothing and no one seemed to reduce her. Rather, even if, over the years, she became as stupid and intractable as anyone, the qualities that we had attributed to her would remain intact. Maybe they would be magnified. Even when we hated her, we ended by respecting her and fearing her. It didn't surprise me, when I thought about it, that Nadia, although she had met Leela only a few times, detested her and wanted to hurt her. Leela had taken Nino from her. Leela had humiliated her in her revolutionary beliefs. Leela was mean and could hit before being hit. Leela was from the proletariat, but rejected any deliverance. In other words, Leela was an honorable enemy, and hurting her could be pure satisfaction, without the store of guilt that a designated victim like Pasquale would certainly arouse. Nadia could truly think of her in that way. How tawdry everything had become over the years. Professor Galliani, her house with a view of the bay, her thousands of books, her paintings, her cultured conversations, Armando, Nadia herself. She was so pretty, so well brought up, when I saw her beside Nino, outside the school, when she welcomed me to the party at her parents' beautiful house. And there was still something incomparable about her when she stripped herself of every privilege with the idea that, in a radically new world, she would have a more dazzling garment. But now? The noble reasons for that denuding had all dissolved. There remained the horror of so much blood stupidly shed, and the villainy of unloading the blame on the former bricklayer, who had once seemed to her the avant-garde of a new humanity, and who now, along with so many others, served to reduce her own responsibilities almost to nothing. I was upset. As I drove toward Naples, I thought of Dede. I felt she was close to making a mistake similar to Nadia's, similar to all mistakes that take you away from yourself. It was the end of July, the day before Dede had got the highest grades on her graduation exam. She was an Airota. She was my daughter. Her brilliant intelligence could only produce the best results. Soon, she would be able to do much better than I had, and even than her father. What I had gained by hard work and much luck, she had taken, and would continue to take, with ease, as if by birthright. Instead, what was her plan? To declare her love for Reno, to sink with him, to rid herself of every advantage, lose herself out of a spirit of solidarity and justice, out of fascination with what doesn't resemble us, because in the muttering of that boy, she saw some sort of extraordinary mind. I asked Ima suddenly, looking at her in the rearview mirror, "Do you like Reno?"
"No, but Dede likes him."
"How do you know?"
"Elsa told me."
"And who told Elsa?"
"Dede."
"Why don't you like Reno?"
"Because he's very ugly."
"And who do you like?"
"Papa."
I saw in her eyes the flame that in that moment she saw blazing around her father. A light, I thought, that Nino would never have had if he had sunk with Leela. The same light that Nadia had lost forever, sinking with Pasquale, and that would abandon Dede if she were lost following Reno. Suddenly, I felt with shame that I could understand and excuse the irritation of Professor Galliani when she saw her daughter on Pasquale's knees. I understood and excused Nino when, one way or another, he withdrew from Leela. And why not? I understood and excused Adele when she had had to make the best of things and accept that I would marry her son. 26. As soon as I was back in the neighborhood, I rang Leela's bell. I found her listless, absent, but now it was typical of her and I wasn't worried. I told her in detail what Nino had said, and only at the end did I report that threatening phrase that concerned her. I asked, "Seriously, can Nadia hurt you?" She assumed a look of nonchalance. "You can be hurt only if you love someone, but I don't love anyone."
"And Reno?"
"Reno's gone." I immediately thought of Dede and her intentions. I was frightened. "Where?" She took a piece of paper from the table. She handed it to me, muttering, "He wrote so well as a child, and now look, he's illiterate." I read the note. Reno, very laboriously, said he was tired of everything, insulted Enzo heavily, announced that he had gone to Bologna to a friend he had met during his military service. 6 lines in all. No mention of Dede. My heart was pounding in my chest. That writing, that spelling, that syntax, what did they have to do with my daughter? Even his mother considered him a failed promise, a defeat, perhaps even a prophecy. Look what would have happened to Tina if they hadn't taken her. "He left by himself?" I asked. "Who would he have left with?" I shook my head uncertainly. She read in my eyes the reason for my concern. She smiled. "You're afraid he left with Dede?" 27. I hurried home, trailed by Ima. I went in, I called Dede, I called Elsa. No answer. I rushed into the room where my older daughters slept and studied. I found Dede lying on the bed, her eyes burning with tears. I felt relieved. I thought that she had told Reno of her love and that he had rejected her. I didn't have time to speak. Ima, maybe because she hadn't realized her sister's state, began talking enthusiastically about her father, but Dede rebuffed her with an insult in dialect, then sat up and burst into tears. I nodded to Ima not to get mad. I said to my oldest daughter gently, "I know it's terrible. I know very well, but it will pass." The reaction was violent. As I was caressing her hair, she pulled away with an abrupt movement of her head, crying, "What are you talking about? You don't know anything. You don't understand anything. All you think about is yourself and the crap you write." Then she handed me a piece of graph paper. Rather, she threw it in my face and ran away. Once Ima realized that her sister was desperate, her eyes began to tear up and turn. I whispered, to keep her occupied, "Call Elsa, see where she is." And I picked up the piece of paper. It was a day of notes. I immediately recognized the fine handwriting of my second daughter. Elsa had written at length to Dede. She explained to her that one can't control feelings, that Reno had loved her for a long time, and that little by little, she too had fallen in love. She knew, of course, that she was causing her pain, and she was sorry, but she also knew that a possible renunciation of the loved person would not fix things. Then she addressed me in an almost amused tone. She wrote that she had decided to give up school, that my cult of study had always seemed to her foolish, that it wasn't books that made people good, but good people who made some good books. She emphasized that Reno was good, and yet he had never read a book. She emphasized that her father was good and had made very good books. The connection between books, people, and goodness ended there. I wasn't sighted. She said goodbye with affection and told me not to be too angry. Dede and Ima would give me the satisfactions that she no longer felt able to give me. To her younger sister, she dedicated a little heart with wings. I turned into a fury. I was angry with Dede, who hadn't realized how her sister, as usual, intended to steal what she valued. "You should have known," I scolded her. "You should have stopped her. You're so intelligent, and you let yourself be tricked by a vain, sly girl." Then I ran downstairs. I said to Leela, "Your son didn't go alone. Your son took Elsa with him." She looked at me, disoriented. "Elsa?" "Yes, and Elsa is a minor. Reno is 9 years older. I swear to God, I'll go to the police and report him." She burst out laughing. It wasn't a mean laugh, but incredulous. She laughed and said, alluding to her son, "But look how much damage he was able to do. I underrated him. He made both young ladies lose their heads. I can't believe it." "Lenu, come here, calm down, sit down. If you think about it, there's more to laugh at than cry about." I said in dialect that I found nothing to laugh at, that what Reno had done was very serious, that I really was about to go to the police. Then she changed her tone. She pointed to the door. She said, "Go to the cops. Go on. What are you waiting for?" I left. But for the moment, I gave up the idea of the police. I went home, taking the steps two at a time. I shouted at Dede, "I want to know where the fuck they went. Tell me immediately." She was frightened. Ima put her hands over her ears, but I wouldn't calm down until Dede admitted that Elsa had met Reno's Bolognese friend once when he came to the neighborhood. "Do you know his name?" "Yes." "Do you have the address, the phone number?" She trembled. She was on the point of giving me the information I wanted. Then, although by now she hated her sister even more than Reno, she must have thought it would be shameful to collaborate, and was silent. "I'll find it myself," I cried, and began to turn her things upside down. I rummaged through the whole house. Then I stopped. While I was looking for yet another piece of paper, a note in a school diary, I realized that a lot else was missing. All the money was gone from the drawer where I normally kept it, and all my jewelry was gone, even my mother's bracelet. Elsa had always been very fond of that bracelet. She said, partly joking and partly serious, that her grandmother, if she had made a will, would have left it to her and not to me. 28. That discovery made me even more determined, and Dede finally gave me the address and telephone number I was looking for. When she made up her mind, despising herself for giving in, she shouted at me that I was just like Elsa. We didn't respect anything or anyone. I silenced her and went to the telephone. Reno's friend was called Moreno. I threatened him. I told him that I knew he sold heroin, that I would get him in such deep trouble that he would never get out of jail. I got nothing. He swore that he didn't know anything about Reno, that he remembered Day-Day, but that this daughter I was talking about, Elsa, he had never met. I went back to Leela. She opened the door, but now Enzo was there, who made me sit down and treated me kindly. I said I wanted to go to Bologna right away. I ordered Leela to go with me. "There's no need," she said. "You'll see that when they run out of money, they'll be back." "How much money did Reno take?" "Nothing. He knows that if he touches even 10 lire, I'll break his bones." I felt humiliated. I muttered, "Elsa took my money and my jewelry." "Because you didn't know how to bring her up." Enzo said to her, "Stop it." She turned against him sharply. "I say what I like. My son is a drug addict. My son didn't study. My son speaks and writes poorly. My son is a good-for-nothing. My son has all the sins. But the one who steals is her daughter. The one who betrays her sister is Elsa." Enzo said to me, "Let's go. I'll go with you to Bologna." We left in the car. We traveled at night. I had scarcely returned from Rome. The trip in the car had tired me. The sorrow and the fury that had arisen had absorbed all my remaining forces, and now that the tension was easing, I felt exhausted. Sitting next to Enzo as we left Naples and got on the highway, what took hold was anxiety for the state in which I had left Dede, fear for what could happen to Elsa, some shame for the way I had frightened Ima, the way I had spoken to Leela, forgetting that Reno was her only child. I didn't know whether to telephone Pietro in America and tell him to come back right away. I didn't know if I really should go to the police. "We'll solve it ourselves," Enzo said, feigning confidence. "Don't worry, it's pointless to hurt the boy." "I don't want to report Reno," I said. "I just want them to find Elsa." It was true. I muttered that I wanted to recover my daughter, go home, pack my bags, not remain a minute longer in that house, in the neighborhood, in Naples. "It makes no sense," I said, "that now Leela and I start fighting about who brought up her children better. And if what happened is her fault or mine, I can't bear it." Enzo listened to me at length, in silence. Then, although I felt he had been angry at Leela for a long time, he began to make excuses for her. He didn't speak about Reno, about the problems he caused his mother, but about Tina. He said, "If a being a few years old dies, she's dead. It's over. Sooner or later you resign yourself. But if she disappears, if you no longer know anything about her, there's not a thing that remains in her place, in your life. Will Tina never return, or will she return? And when she returns, will she be alive or dead?" "Every moment," he murmured, "you're asking where she is. Is she a gypsy on the street? Is she at home with rich people who have no children? Are people making her do horrible things and selling the photographs and films? Did they cut her up and sell her heart for a high price so it could be transplanted to another child's chest? Are the other pieces underground, or were they burned? Or is she under the ground intact because she died accidentally after she was abducted? And if earth and fire didn't take her, and she is growing up who knows where, what does she look like now? What will she become later? If we meet her on the street, will we recognize her? And if we recognize her, who will give us back everything we lost of her? Everything that happened when we weren't there, and little Tina felt abandoned?" At a certain point, While Enzo spoke in his laborious but dense sentences, I saw his tears in the glow of the headlights. I knew he wasn't talking only about Leela, but was trying to express his own suffering as well. That trip with him was important. I still find it hard to imagine a man with a finer sensibility than his. At first he told me what, every day, every night in those 4 years, Leela had whispered or shouted. Then he urged me to talk about my work and my dissatisfactions. I told him about the girls, about books, about men, about resentments, about the need for approval. And I mentioned all my writing, which now had become obligatory. I struggled day and night to feel myself present, to not let myself be marginalized, to fight against those who considered me an upstart little woman without talent. Persecutors, I muttered, whose only purpose is to make me lose my audience. And not because they're inspired by any elevated motives, but rather for the enjoyment of keeping me from improvement, or to carve out for themselves or for their protégés some wretched power harmful to me. He let me vent. He praised the energy I put into things. "You see," he said, "how excited you get. The effort has anchored you to the world you've chosen. It's given you broad and detailed expertise in it. Above all, it has engaged your feelings. So life has dragged you along, and Tina, for you, is certainly an atrocious episode. Thinking about it makes you sad, but it's also, by now, a distant fact. For Leela, on the other hand, in all these years, the world collapsed as if it were hearsay, and slid into the void left by her daughter, like the rain that rushes down a drainpipe. She remains frozen at Tina, and feels bitter toward everything that continues to be alive, that grows and prospers. Of course, he said, she is strong. She treats me terribly. She gets angry with you. She says ugly things. But you don't know how many times she has fainted just when she seemed tranquil, washing the dishes, or staring out the window at the stradone. 29. In Bologna, we found no trace of Reno and my daughter. Even though Moreno, frightened by Enzo's fierce calm, dragged us through streets and hangouts where, according to him, if they were in the city, the two would certainly have been welcomed. Enzo telephoned Leela often, I, Day-Day. We hoped that there would be good news, but there wasn't. At that point, I was seized by a new crisis. I no longer knew what to do. I said again, I'm going to the police. Enzo shook his head. Wait a little. Reno has ruined Elsa. You can't say that. You have to try to look at your daughters as they really are. It's what I do continuously. Yes, but you don't do it well. Elsa would do anything to make Day-Day suffer, and they are in agreement on a single point, tormenting Ima. Don't make me say mean things. It's Leela who sees them like that, and you're repeating what she says. Leela loves you, admires you, is fond of your daughters. It's me who thinks these things, and I'm saying them to help you be reasonable. Calm down. You'll see. We'll find them. We didn't find them. We decided to return to Naples. But as we were nearing Florence, Enzo wanted to call Leela again to find out if there was any news. When he hung up, he said, bewildered, Dede needs to talk to you, but Lena doesn't know why. Is she at your house? No, she's at yours. I called immediately. I was afraid that Ima was sick. Dede didn't even give me a chance to speak. She said, I'm leaving tomorrow for the United States. I'm going to study there. I tried not to shout. Now is not the moment for that conversation. As soon as possible, we'll talk about it with Papa. One thing has to be clear, Mama. Elsa will return to this house only when I am gone. For now, the most urgent thing is to find out where she is. She cried to me in dialect. That bitch telephoned a little while ago. She's at grandma's.